Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line Podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Joining me on the other end of the line today, Mr. Bill Cooksey, helping me co-host and drive the bus, and also joining us, a fan favorite, I've got to say, Mr. Jeff Foles. Guys, how are y'all?
Good, man. How are you guys doing?
Doing well this morning.
Awesome.
Looking like spring outside my window.
It is here, too. I got the doors open up here in Illinois, and it's about 50 degrees, and thinking about riding a Harley or wetting a line in this high-water river we got out here.
Oof.
You know, when you say
that river's scaring our friends down south.
Well, it's bad here, too. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. There's a street below me's closed already, and they got some ferries closed. We got a lot of ferry boats crossing it up here, and it's getting ready to crest and go down, but then I think when all that snow melts up there, they're predicting, you know, high as it was in 1993, which was devastating for us.
When you say that your shop is on a body of water, I saw a video on your personal Facebook page the other day where it was about a foot from getting in your building. I didn't realize that you were literally on the water.
Well, that was over. I had a shop on the Mississippi River, and it right on the river. And it took a lot to get in there, but it did get in there last October. And I honestly was tuning calls in October in hip boots, swear to God. I had everything up on tables and I had it up on a bench, and that's exactly what I was doing. And I'd bring stuff home, do whatever I had to do to keep things going, because it's October and people's wanting their stuff, and that's when I said, we got to move out of here. So I moved to a new building and got everything moved out of there, and we're moved in a new building, and I can see the water, but it doesn't get in this building, you know. It's quite a ways away from me. It's got to get pretty high to get into me. So.
Now, listen, I'm not going to get back into last week's episode again because I think that we all got our opinions out there as far as corn is concerned, but good grief, that episode was off the charts.
Yeah,
I mean,
I tell you what, I can't plant any more corn. I'm wore out for a week or two of that. It's all good. It stirred up a lot of, you know, it's good when waterfowlers talk together, well, good, bad, whatever. Get your opinion. Everybody's got an opinion, and it's good to hear them all, and it's good to explain your part and hear somebody else's, and it may change your thinking and whatever. So, yeah, it was good. But I planted enough corn. I'm done now.
I picked around the one that came up somewhere inside the thread, and, Bill, you saw this, was to have a live videotape roundtable with people like yourself, Jeff, you know, different people that have a little bit of expertise when it comes to this.
Mm-hmm.
And film it. Broadcast it out to the world. Broadcast these
discussions. Get a biologist or two and get, you know, some guys who can actually speak as adults like we did, and I think it would be interesting from people with a lot of different views.
It would, usually when you get something like that, you can usually get something together. Here in Illinois, a lot of time when they set the seasons, and they set the zones or something. It happens every few years. They had one at my shop one time where all the guys from the state, DNR guys, came down from the state of Illinois, and biologists and all that, you know. And I'm not saying they know everything about it. They're very smart people. And then a lot of hunters, you know, that had clubs or whatever. And we all got together at my shop, about 10 of us, and roundtable discussion. Next thing you know, we had some season dates, and people walked away happy, some halfway happy and some not happy. But it overall, it come out and give a good mid-range, and it was all good for everybody, you know. So yeah, I think that'd be a great idea.
I think it would break the internet pertaining to duck hunting. There would be so many people that viewed that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I believe so, you know, and people have their opinions and whatever, and they'd have their people there, you know, and have their representative there from their area or whatever, their thoughts. And, you know, like you said, if you had 6, 8, 10 people, something like that, you know, along like Bill said, you know, with biologists, it'd be real good.
Mm-hmm.
We just can't sit around and drag our feet and do nothing, though, I think, all the time. I think we do that too much, and then we find ourselves in a jam. And then we all hurry and try to get something done. You know, I think it is time that we get together and do something, you know, and talk for all the flyways. So.
Right.
Well, Bill, Jeff, last week we talked a little bit about your parents and the influence. I guess one of the principal foundations that were taught to you when you were younger was hard work. Which,
right.
That is a common principle around successful people that have been on this podcast before. But are there any more things that you look inward today and see? And I'm glad Mom and Dad taught me that when I was younger.
Right.
Any more of those?
Yeah, there were so many of them. I mean, I think a lot of it is because when you don't have much, now don't get me wrong, we had clothes, we had anything we needed, you know, that way, and food and whatever. But when you don't have, you know, when you don't have much, it teaches you to really drive to have what others do, you know, or be successful. It did me. I just didn't want to sit around and not have nothing and do the very best I could at what I loved. You know, I've been stuck in those jobs like a lot of people have where I don't like them and whatever, and that's kind of a, you know, a dead-end route, you know, and it was for me, and I was stuck in one of them as a mechanic. When I was young, I was a gearhead, and I grew up in the 70s, and I had a 68 Camaro, a 69 Camaro, in fact, I had 269 Camaro, you know, and I was a gearhead. I was drag racing, had motors pulled up. You would laugh. I had every limb in my dad's yard. I had a come along. He'd bring it, or a chain fall from work, and I had a trouble light drug out with a million miles of cord from the house out there working at nighttime on cars, you know, changing motors and doing this and transmissions and all that, and that's a lot of hard work. You know, it's always said it's the drag race guys are the dumbest guys there are, you know, or stock car guys in the small area because you spend $1,000 a week to win 75 on Saturday night, you know. But it's the drive.
Sounds like bass fishing.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing. Exact same thing. So exactly. I've been in that too. So, yeah, but you don't have that drive, that winning drive. And I think that drag racing and all that, and I was my cousin, God bless his soul, he had a car wreck and dead, but he was about a wild man as I ever seen. But they owned an Evan Reed outboard motor place, and he raced boats all the time. And I was he was a lot older than me, but I was kind of his sidekick, and I'm the one that went out in the John boat and picked him up when the boat flipped and all that. And then we'd back in, pull the boat out, and we'd rework the motor and go all over the place, you know. And it gives you that drive to win. I think that's a lot of it, you know, or be the very best, you know. And if you've got that drive and you want to be that and do the very best you can, you know, it's hard work. You know, there's nothing harder than that, you know. And then growing up, my grandpa having a farm and then the construction work and all that, you know, I think that was, you know, a big part of it. And I know I see today, you know, a kid goes, you hardly ever see a young kid, you know, 14, 15 years old working anywhere, you know, and I'd just always pat them on the back if I see one because you don't see that, you know. But when I started, and I'm not saying I was anything, this is just my life, you know, and I started at 12 and 13 working in that outboard motor shop, you know, and pumping gas when gas was 35 cents a gallon And, you know, and everybody pumped your gas and worked your windshield and checked your oil. That was me, you know. So I did that as a kid. And so, you know, with all that, you know, you just learn. And then we had jobs after school and worked. And, you know, if you wanted something, that's what you had to do. So put up hay, you know. I mean, the big deals around here, you know, a lot of summers, you know, all I did was put up square bales of hay, you know, on hay in crews, you know, for if he's lucky, you got a nickel bale. So it was pretty rough, and that's about as hard. That's probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, put up hay, and makes you a man.
Hey, I want to ask y'all something real quick. I was thinking about this the other day. We're take a little detour. Get back on the main highway after this.
Sure.
Why don't parents make their kids have a job once they get, say, you know, just a part-time job working on the farm like you're talking about? I always grew up with a job. Growing up, what's come into parenting that's changed that, though?
Well, let me ask you. No, I'll ask you, answer that with a question. When's the last time you ever seen a parent spank a kid?
Hit last
him with night. A ice water or a belt or anything like that. Like, I know you boys are old enough; you probably got all that. But
yep,
you know, I mean, there's a lot of things change. A lot of things don't happen. You know, like that doesn't happen anymore. And I don't know why. Like you said, I don't know why they don't push them to go get a job. But it's not so much even the parents. The kids don't have the drive to go do that, you know. And I guess if the parents refuse to give them money to go do something, you know, my whole deal was is, hey, if I want this hot rod car, or if I want something to go out on Saturday night, or if I want, you know, a new fishing pole or a new shotgun, you know, I remember working in a cornfield all in detossing corn up here for seed corn in the hot cornfield all summer to buy me a Browning A5. Belgium made one, you know, and it worked all summer in that hot heat to do that. But the kids don't have that drive to do that anymore. Usually mom and dad's buying it for them, or they just don't care. Yeah. So,
as someone who has a high school senior right now, so I'm in the – I know teenagers, a hell of a lot of them, and coach 35 of them on a trap team. I'll say this, it's not – those jobs aren't out there in most areas – the way they used to be. It's not to say
right.
A kid can't find a part-time job, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Look, when I was 13, 14 years old, I worked on a farm, I mowed yards. There was all kinds of stuff
you know, that I could
do to make money, and it was easy without having even a formal job.
Right.
You know, now a lot of them won't hire a kid, or if you live in the middle of the city, it's that much worse. None of my neighbors will hire a kid to mow their yard because they're worried about getting sued. So
yeah, I guess that's it, too.
It's not as easy.
Yeah.
And then I know with mine, he's applied for jobs, but every time when they start looking at the schedule, you know, his primary job is keeping his grades where they need to be.
Right, and
you know,
I think that's a
good
lot
job
more.
Of that. And then he shoots trap, and we haven't,
yeah.
he hasn't found one yet that actually works. So, you know, and that's not to say if he was more aggressive, he couldn't, but it's not as easy as it was. And they have a lot of other stuff put on them at times, I think.
Well, I think that's a lot, too. They are a lot put on them. I mean, when I was a kid, going to college wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you weren't working for that. I was working until I can't get away to high school to do something else. That's what I wasn't a
right.
guy that liked school, you know. And I was the first one as a senior to take the half-a-day deal so I could go work half a day. But, yeah, I know that. And around here in the country, a lot of that's still here. But this is like that hay job I was talking about. You know, I mean, everybody in the county could get a job putting up hay if they wanted to. Well, now everybody's round bales. Nobody has it, you know. And so there's no square bales, you know, hardly anymore. There's no gas station to pump gas at like you used to be, or worse windshields, or those type of jobs, like you said, they're done. They're gone, you know.
So, hey, when I was in high school, our football team, we hauled hay. Was part of what we did to help build a new field house for the football team.
Yeah, that's
the team
cool.
raised
yeah.
the money through hauling hay.
Mm-hmm. And that's not easy work.
No.
But getting back to what he was asking, you know, what Rocky was asking, you know, I mean, with that belt, you know, he was asking me, and that's what built me the drive, I think, you know. And then when I got into the ironworkers, when I was apprenticed, I was just I don't know. There was something about it that drove me. I wanted to be there, would interest me, and I liked it, and I wanted to be the best, you know, and be as good as I possibly could, you know. And so I just applied myself and worked super hard. And I think that's probably as much as anything that taught me I want to do my own thing one of these days. I want to be the best at this and best at that, you know. And I think that it's pretty nice drive you got. And along with that, and this is going off the track just a little bit, but it's a big part of it. When I was in school, I started playing drums. It was in fourth grade, and I worked my way up. And then we had a band that went to every state DM, won every state competition, and all this here. And I loved that. And that was a big drive to be a winner, you know. So I think that applied all this above, what I'm saying, this applied right on to me, which took me into the beginning of mine, you know, as a calling contest to take the drive to win it, to be somebody, to do whatever, you know. And so, yeah, that is. So that was where the hard work part come in, I guess.
So a competitive drive pushed you, even when it was just with yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it started out, you know, I mean, like I said, with the hot rod cars and that, you know, I mean, you wanted the best looking one, fastest car around, you know, and I won't lie about it. I mean, I was a street outlaw, you know, we raced on the streets for a few bucks and whatever, you know, and so you wanted that fastest car, and you worked all week to do that, and wrenching on them cars ain't an easy job when you're laying out in the yard doing it, you know, shade tree mechanic. So yeah, I think it was a lot of it probably even started right then, you know. So
drive and hard work are two. Mm-hmm. What else? I mean, what else has played a huge part in who you are today?
My mom and dad went to church every Sunday, you know, and that's a big part of it. You learned to do things right. You learned respect, you know. If you didn't respect, you know, you was going outside cutting a switch and you was going to get across the back of your leg, you know. So you respect everybody, and that was
that the
part
worst? That's the worst walk ever you'll make in your life. If you've never picked your own switch, if you're listening to this, you never picked your own switch, it is the worst walk you'll ever make in your life.
It's worse, and you better pick one today. It's a green, nice green one, not a broke one that's going to break on the first whack. Then you're going to go really good. Or I don't know whether it was the switch or one of those fly swatters with the metal screen in the middle that was half torn. I don't know which is worse, one of the two of them. I hated that fly swatter across the back of your legs. So, but, yeah, it's like you said, it was the worst walk in the world going picking that switch out. Yeah, or wait till Dad comes home. So you knew he was
That's
hot and
exactly
tired
right.
and didn't want to deal with you. So. But, yeah, that was all a big part of it, you know. That was all a whole big part of it was there, you know. And I went from that into dirt bikes. And you know, I had dirt bikes all my life. And I got into racing them and enduro races and stuff. And it was always, I don't know, I just always challenged myself, you know, to try to do the best you can, you know. So, and I think a lot of it, too, is and, again, I'm not bragging about nothing. But, you know, a lot of the stuff I did was life-threatening, you know. I mean, like whether it was racing or whatever, or the motorcycles, whatever, probably more so was as being an iron worker, but connecting iron up on a building, you know. And because back then we didn't have, I mean, there was no safety belts. We'd laugh at them. They told you to put a safety belt on, you know. And you'd jump on a headache ball. And if you don't know what a headache ball is, that's the ball that's on the end of a crane on the cable that goes up. And you'd step on that, put your foot on that. The other guy would put his foot there, and you'd cross your legs around the cable, and up that thing you'd go, and you'd step off that thing about 250 foot in the air, whatever, 100 foot, whatever he was, off onto a 6-8-inch beam and grab a column there, and off you go and wait for the iron to come up, you know. And you love doing it, you know. So I don't know if that was, and, you know, I had a lot of close calls, and so I don't know. I don't know if it's all the challenges of all that stuff all my life or what, you know, but there's a lot to do with that.
Jeff, I know you kind of stepped off. I kind of interrupted you when you stepped off into this one, but discipline from your parents, and you're talking about your mom and dad going to church, because I know a very important part of your life now is your faith.
Yes, it's more so than it ever been. I mean, I grew up as I was a Catholic for 57 years, and I was an altar boy. Went to 6 years of nuns, and these were the nuns with the big white long robes down there and the headpieces on and all that. And you want to talk about beatings? I'll give you a beating worse than any man ever did. And I got a lot of beating from them. And I don't know if it was abuse or what, but, you know, I was an altar boy and the whole time went to church every Sunday and Catholic church every Sunday. And then, you know, and I made another step forward, you know, and I went there. And, my sister taught, was a principal at a Catholic school in a big city for 40 years, just retired. And, of course, my whole family's been Catholics forever. And I don't know, I just got, after I went to prison, you know, I was, like I told you before about being, I was thrown in a cell with a Bible, and that's all you had. And after, you know, I stepped into another faith, and I'm a Southern Baptist now, and I have nothing against any faith. It's just, to me, it's just about believing in God, you know, and God is your almighty Savior. So, I've seen what He can do for you, and what God does for you, yeah, I do a lot there. And now today, those drums I was talking about, I play drums in a praise group at church, and it's, you know, I spend a lot of time with my pastor, and I pray every day, read the Bible every day, and whatever. And I always tell my pastor, look, I am a work in progress. I got a long way to go. But you know, I mean, yeah, it's a whole different life now if you put Jesus Christ first, you know. So. And, you know, I have to pray about it every day. You know, I wake up every morning, the first thing I do, you know, is get on my Bible app or in my Bible and read every day. Like I said, I've got a long way to go here, you know, but at least I'm starting in the right direction. You know, so that's a big part of my life, is my faith.
Well, I think that is four great characteristics: discipline, faith, hard work, and a drive. Because I think that's four huge components of a successful person, if you look around anywhere. You agree with that, Bill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the faith is underappreciated by far too many
people. It
really is. And I don't mean just a faith in your Creator. There's more to faith than even that. So,
it gives
you a foundation to build from.
Exactly. It absolutely does. You know, and if you finally, I found out with my hard head that, you know, when I was was real successful and doing great and doing this, and we'll talk about that more later down the line, but I'll just hit a little highlight here. You know, I was all that there. You know, the bottom line was, I told my pastor, you know, we had a lot of long talks about this. I didn't need God for anything. I didn't think I did. I didn't think I needed Him. I had everything I wanted. I had money, had whatever. I wasn't happy, but I had anything I wanted, you know. And I think it's, you know, and there's a Bible saying, you know, and I'm not on here to preach, but, you know, there's one verse, you know, it talks about, you know, it's easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than a wealthy man to get into heaven. And there's a lot to that. I get where that comes from. That is so true, you know. Unless you take that wealth and still praise the Lord for it, you know, you're going to end up somewhere like I did. And He will wake you up. And if you don't think so, just give Him a try. Try Him once. And he'll wake you up. He did me. When I sit there looking up about the second day in that prison cell, and I'm looking around at all these, and all, you know, all God's children, but they're all, you know, either rapists or drug dealers or shot their brother-in-law or did whatever they did. I look at this night, and I'm in there, and I say, I'm in here for shooting ducks. You know, it woke me up pretty quick. I didn't do this, you know. Good Lord allowed me to be here, straightened me out, you know. And then at the end of it, He really waked me up when He threw me down a hole for 54 days and go. And I never understood in the Bible how Paul and all the different ones that talked about them and John the Baptist, all of them had been in prison, spent time in prison. And I thought, what is the deal, all these guys in prison in the Bible, you know. Well, now I know. Because He'll wake you up there, but He'll get your attention. But okay, excuse me. I won't preach to you no more today.
So, Jeff, I'll tell you this. You know, everyone in the industry who knew you prior to going in and when you were going in said, well, you know, if there's one guy in this business that's enough of a badass and tough guy to go through that and come out the other side stronger and better, it's Jeff.
Well, it's been a long road.
People saw you as a driven person, you know.
And you know, the good Lord's blessed me with that, and I think it all works out to show your testimony, you know. And I'll tell you a couple stories that happened here later on about, you know, with that, but with my testimony and stuff that's happened since then for the good of people. But Yeah, so it does. In this business, to be successful, you have got to have some drive. I mean, you know how it is, Bill. It will tear you apart. You know, it's you know, I mean, it takes 7 days a week, and you answer the phone when you shouldn't be, and you shouldn't be laxing, and you just have to do that, you know, and it will. You better have some drive, or you ain't going to make it in this business. It's a dog-eat-dog world, and it's way worse now than it used to be.
Lots of money doesn't help. We've got plenty of people with a lot of money get in it and lose their ass.
You know, and I'm not absolutely not saying that's just a brag or what I had or what of this here. I'm not at all. I'm just not. It's actually telling how stupid I was. So I'm really into Harleys, okay? So I had all, and I was miserable. And my home life wasn't very good and all that. So I try to buy your happiness. And so I look, sitting out on a Sunday morning, I'm sitting out in my garage. I'm looking, and I've got two real nice trucks, a Suburban and another nice truck sitting there. My wife at the time had a Harley truck sitting there. And I've got four Screaming Eagle Harleys and a chopper sitting in my garage and a dirt bike.
Wow.
And I'm just sitting there looking at all this crap. And when I do, I try to buy your happiness. It lasts about 30 days. And then you ain't happy again. You try to buy something else or do whatever. And I said, I'm selling all this stuff. She goes, what do you mean you're selling? I said, 3/4 of this is going. I'm keeping me a Harley. You can have one, but that's it. The rest of this is gone. So I started selling it, you know, and all that, you know, at that time. But that's what you'll do when you're not happy and you have the you know, resources to do it. You'll just try to buy your happiness, you know. But I was just going the wrong direction every way I could, you know. So,
do you think you're trying to fill a hole? You think you're trying to fill a hole, Jeff?
You are, because your time, and Bill well knows this, at the time you are going 1,000 miles an hour, and when you are the only one that owns the business and you're the only one really doing it, but I mean, people are pulling at you for every direction, and if you've got the drive and the heart and all that, you won't turn anybody down. And you'll answer every one of them. And some of them you should have turned down, you know, because they'll take up a lot of your time. But and you are trying to fill a hole because you don't have anything, you know. And the hunting, even the hunting aspect, yeah, you're killing them, it's fun and all that. But it's you know, it's 5 months. It's a grueling 5 months. You got two videos to do, and a TV show, and all this here, sponsors to take care of, and all that, and a business to run on the side. And it gets to where it's just a job. Yeah, I mean, you're killing them. You know, yeah, you love it or you wouldn't do it. But it turns out it is just. You know, that deal like I have now where I just go hunting with my buddies, that you don't have that then. You know, you're going with sponsors or clients or whoever, you know. You're not going with your down-home buddies. And I even know that with my boy, Cole. You know, when he was young growing up, he hunted more with all my buddies, probably in another pit. He's very fortunate to have great places to go. But he probably spent more time with those guys hunting than he did me, because I've always had the clients or the high rollers or the sponsors or whatever hunting, you know. So, yeah, there is a big, big hole. A big void.
There's a big difference between having fun and being happy.
Exactly. 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 There's exactly. And, you know, and then, you know, I had a lot of, and I won't go into that, I had a lot of personal problems at home, and which what led to a lot of the demise at the end. But that is this, when you've got that, and when you have got that problem at home also, now you've really got a problem. Your mind's not in the right spot. You just, your mind's there all the time and wondering what's happening and, you know, what's going to happen and what that's what. At the end of my deal, that was probably what tore me up the worst than anything. Was the home life was terrible. And when that is, it's everything else is a mess. You know, it's hard to stay focused.
That's well, Jeff, perfect. Last week when we ended that podcast, we being the call maker. I'm sure that you probably remember that first call you were ever given.
Yeah.
And it was something special about that call.
Yeah. Yeah. The one I was given is probably ever both you guys used or whatever, and it was the only thing to use back then that everybody used was a D2 Olt. And it was an old D2 Olt and had the black reeds in them. Oh, boy, back then you had to have black reeds because, you know, clear and white ones wasn't a good one. You know, you had to have a black one. Sat around and make corks for them. And I remember we used to take, it's funny now, I laugh almost every time. I use Santa Preme wedges, you know, for my wedges and my duck calls. And And of course, you know, we've used cork for years. And but back then, I remember cutting up my those pink erasers you used to have in school.
Yeah.
I used to cut them things up and use them years ago, and that's what I'd always use for a wedge. You know, so I had my own kind of Santa Supreme wedge way back when I was a kid. So I kind of laugh at it today. I thought, why didn't I invent this back then? But anyway, yeah, I remember that and practicing for hours and upon hours and upon hours. And there, if there was any tapes to be found or anything to watch like that, I sure as heck didn't have them, or we didn't have them, you know, or nothing to play them on or whatever, you know, because, you know, you just, the only way I learned, I listened to my dad and you know, all his buddies that we hunted with and all that. They were all good duck callers, you know, and that's who I listened to. And as far as goose calling, we didn't have any geese. So where I was at, if you saw a goose flying over, there was a V'd up, you know, 500-yard bunch of geese head for Southern Illinois, you know, and we're 3.5 hours above them. So that's, you know, we didn't even get a goose, you know. So far as a goose calling, there wasn't a lot of that, but at that when I was a kid. But, oh, yeah, I sat in the back of the blind many times, listen, you know, and mess with them duck. And I'd come home from duck hunting, and my dad had a little pond behind the house. I was just a kid, so I made me a blind there. And you could sit there.
Jeff, let me ask this. So is that how you learned, sitting in the back of the blind, just trying to imitate what the older guys were doing?
I just tried to learn what they were doing, and then I would come home. And I would come home, and I would blow that thing. I could go outside. We had, I don't know, my grandpa had a farm and stuff there, and I could be anywhere I wanted to. He had a little pond behind our house, a little big pond, and you could sit there for 10 lifetimes, never kill a duck off of it. But, of course, I had me 6 decoys out there just in case, and a little blind I built myself out there, and I was just a kid. I blew and blew and blew and blew that duck call, you know, and then that's how I learned. So finally, after a few years, you get good enough, you know, they'll let you, maybe let you blow until they get close, and then you better shut up. So that was the height of my, that's how I got started.
So you just became one of the best callers around, right? I mean, just
well,
no other way to put that.
I got some trophies hanging up, I guess, you know, maybe somebody, I just lucked into some good judges or whatever, but I never was satisfied. And then I guess that one of the next things that happened to me, years later, you know, of course the D2 Volt was there and all that, and that lasted forever. And Bill, you'll get a real big kick out of this. Bill, did you ever know a man named Denny Ward?
Yes.
From Jerseyville. Okay. Well, Denny and I have been great buddies. He's older than I am, but we've been great buddies forever. Denny had a little sporting goods store. But even before this, we hunted together quite a bit. Denny was a great caller, won the Illinois State and several different ones at, you know, way back when. And Denny got to be friends with Butch Richenbach. So he would go down there, and next thing you know, Denny molded the Richentone, basically, and he called it a Mallard Magnet. Remember that? It's a black call.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so that tone board, and at that time, you had to put 3 farms up to build a mold at that time, you know, because it was a lot of money, a lot different than today. But anyway, so he decides, he gets up enough money and molds this call, and the tone board on it was horrible. Now, this, you know, we had a jig, and we would sit in a duck blind, swear to God, in his garage or duck blind with a file, and filing all these calls. And that's when I went into that call. And so I used that forever. And that call, to kind of tell you the history, that's so people know it, that call has went from Denny selling them all over back then. When Buck was with Bush, remember that white call that Buck had, that white polycarbonate call he had? That's it. That's the call right there. Denny, Buck would pay him so much for the mold or whatever, you know, and Buck produced them, whatever. That was Denny's mold. And then I would have, I wouldn't go down there, but I was at Denny's shop, and he sold Richentones, and I would have, this is a long, long time, years and years ago, and I'd have Buck turn me, have him get me 2, I wouldn't have Buck do it, he would, he just called and ordered them, 2 Coca-Cola, and I don't even know if they were Coca-Cola back then, but it would be 2 wooden calls. And a year, each year, because you know how wood is, and I'd throw them in the trash, tone boards in the trash after that, and then get another next year. But I blew Denny's plastic call. And the reason I wanted a wood one was, is those calls at that time, now that's just my calling, that you could either get loud and high, but it never had no mid-range to bring it down. You know what I'm saying? You either had,
yeah.
So I'd use the polycarbonate, one of the high-range stuff and all that there, because we kill a lot of migrators up here, and then I'd switch to the wood call when I get, you know. So that's kind of a little history of how that started. Well, then that call went on when Buck got done with it or whatever. Denny had the mold and was trying to sell me the mold, and I'm wanting to get in the business. Now, this is back in the 90s, I think. And so that call then, I'm just giving you a history of this call. So I talked Tim Grounds. Tim Grounds didn't have a duck call at the time, none, any, just a goose call. And I was working with Tim, doing a lot of stuff with him. I said, why don't you get some calls molded from Denny, and we'll sell them duck calls. Because we were going, me and him and Zink was going all over, you know, selling us. Everybody's wanting a duck call. I said, hey, bub, I don't want none of that. Yeah, I ain't getting that duck call, but I'm a goose man, you know. You know how he talks. I said, come on, Grounds, just get these things. Hey, if I get them, you're putting them together. I said, all right, whatever. I'll make the deal happen. Hey, let me see one of them. I said, just trust me. So I want black and clear. That's all I want, black and clear. I said, all right. So, you know, Grounds, if he needed 50 calls to sell, he ordered 500. So that's just what he did.
Yeah.
So all the boxes, everything. So I had all these calls. I put those calls. We sold them all over the place. And then the next, we sold them to Final Approach when I was with them. And we went from that, and I was putting them together and selling them for Final Approach. And then that got sold off to Lohmann and all that there, you know, before it's all over here. But, yeah. So that's kind of the history of that call and how that all started that. So yeah. And
hey,
in between that time,
Jeff, you brought it up, so I'm not gonna not ask about it, because I think one of the most unique relationships, because the man has a huge tree that a lot of fruit was bore up on or were a part of. I don't want to say make it demeaning or sound demeaning or anything, but Tim Grounds.
Tim Grounds.
Man, you and Tim Grounds, man, y'all had an unbelievable relationship.
Yeah, we everybody kind of thinks that, you know, we grew up together. No, that's not true. Tim was 3.5 hours away from me, and when I did go to Southern Illinois and guided, and, you know, and when I went hunting, he went to Crab Orchard, which is about, that's where he's from, that area, from Crab Orchard Lake, and I was down at Horseshoe Lake, which is about an hour and a half apart. So I was, we were in two different areas. Yeah, and so we were down, that's where I was at. So I didn't even know who he was, really. I'd heard his name a few times and whatever, and that was about it. Well, he was 6 months younger than me. And so I come, one day I was down, and this is how long ago this has been, and everybody, like I said, once we met, we just became friends. But one of my buddies down in Southern Illinois said, look at this call here. Of course, we all blew flutes forever. You know, we mouth called for years and resonant cavities, then went to flutes, and then everybody blew a flute for 100 years, and then here come a short reed, you know. And I was blowing a Night and Hail when they first come out with a short reed. The first one I ever remember, everybody talks about, but I'm just telling you what I remember, is a Night and Hail. It was a Magnum, not a Mag Clucker, but it was a Double Cluck. Then
double
they come
cluck.
Out with a Double Cluck Plus, you know, but the first one was a Double Cluck.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blowing one of them. So I heard a guy down there, said, look at this new call. It was a half breed. Well, you just don't pick a half breed up and call it. You better be a pretty good caller, you know. And so anyway, I said, where do I get one? And they said, well, that guy up there, Grounds, got him up there. So I took a ride up there and went and got one. He hand engraved it, you know, and wrote he handwrite numbers on them at the time. And that's how the relationship started. And then I started selling calls for him up here in my area. So I'd go down and buy calls, and I'd resell them. I was just like a little dealer, small dealer for him. And, you know, all this led into, hey, we're all blowing, you know, before this, you know, we started blowing a contest, and then we all traveling together. And back then, you know, in the goose call contest, now you'll go and there's several different call maker guys there. But when you went to a contest then, if it was anywhere in the Midwest other than out east where Sean Mann's guys would pop in, it was 100% him. I mean, if there's 15, 20 callers there, they were all his guys. You know, they're all blowing a ground flute. That's all there was. You know, and then Skip Campbell, he'd have a guy or two, skipper calls, you know, later on. But, yeah, for years and years, that's all it was, you know.
And then the McCrees and...
They had a modified, Gary and Allen, they modified an A-50,
Oakley.
Which is... Yeah, it was an A-50, mm-hmm. which is, bottom line, it's the same thing, you know, basically.
Yeah,
you know, I hate
exactly.
to say that, but, it's
it is.
But it's awful close. But, yeah, that was, and there was no rival. The rivalries were amongst yourselves, you know. It's not like it was mm-hmm. in, it's amongst yourself, and it was tough. You know, you want to talk, there was, if you went to a contest, normally it would be Troy Dishner and McCrees and myself and Zink, Brian Sullivan, Grounds, he blew in all of them, Alty Lanham, Adam Rometta, mm-hmm. you know, that whole crew of guys there,
Stoner.
You know. And some, excuse me?
Stoner.
Yeah. There was all this
Ben.
Whole, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, Ben Stoner was one of them, yeah. He was involved there. Bobby Marino. Yeah, there was a whole Matt Porter. There was, and I sure don't want to forget anybody, and I'm sure I am, but that was the crew you were going against, you know. And when you went to the, I don't care what anybody says, anywhere in the world, when you went to the world contest, to me, was never, that wasn't where they were all at. Where they were all at was when you went to the Winchester World down there in Marion in September. That's where the
mm-hmm.
best of the best was, you know, and that's who you had to
yeah.
beat. So it was a whole different, a little bit different ballgame, but yeah, it was a, tough crowd, real tough crowd. You know, and you walk up against a bunch of those boys, you know, McCrees and you walk against them and Zink and the conditioner and Grounds, and, you know, you walk in there, but you better be on your game, you know. But I'll say something about Tim, you know, he'd blow a reed or something, which a fluke, you blew him all the time. You know, he'd blow a reed, he'd stop everything, fix it for you. Hey, bub, there, I get that fixed for you. Here, let me fix that, you know. Get outside and blow that, you know. You know, so he is very, very helpful. He wanted to win as bad as anybody, even though they were his guys. I mean, he was glad you won, but he's a competitor. You know, he wanted to win. You know, and he did win many of them. You know, as everybody knows. But so we developed that relationship, and then Freddie and I got traveling across the country for Tim. You know, and selling all his stuff, and as Tim hated doing shows. He did not like doing shows, you know, at all. It was not his gig that he wanted to do. He wanted some. He'd sit there the first day and go, boy, I wish I wasn't here, you know. And, but, yeah, so I did a lot of shows with the man, you know, and had a lot of fun with him on the road.
Which is funny because Tim liked people.
Oh.
He loved talking to you.
Oh, that part's fine. Yeah. Yeah, that part's fine. Yeah, he loved that part, you know. And he's a great people person. And all the above, you know, he is a great man, you know. I mean, he was a pioneer of the goose calling, you know. I mean, that was, I don't care what anybody says about it, anybody can claim whatever. And yeah, he had, and he was the first to admit, you know, with the, you know, when he came out the half breed and the short read, it was the Hess boys helped him. And then when he, you know, when he did these first one, and that was just out of high school, you know, he's modifying A-50s and then took that and went on and made a, you know, a way better mousetrap than that was. And he's very, you know, and he gave all those people credit, you know. And I got to I give him all credit in the world, you know. I mean, he taught me as much about it. But it was kind of like when I was, you know, duck calling, I was a kid. There was no teacher, really, but I was around the best teacher in the world. I was around the best caller, you know. Like, I'd guide down there at Crab Orchard for years, and I stayed at his house for sometimes 20, 30 days, you know, where we're guiding down there. And, of course, at nighttime, we're putting calls together in the basement. And, you know, Tim could do anything, but he was the most, but he had a hard time changing a tire. He wasn't mechanically inclined. And, but, man, he could put a call together. He could do anything in the world like that, catch fish, kill geese, do whatever. And I say to this day, as many people as I've ever hunted with, I've never hunted with anybody that could kill a goose like he could, you know, or talk to geese like he could. You know, he's probably the best in the field goose caller that ever walked. And he just knew what to say to him. And, but anyway, with all, you know, I stayed down there, we put calls, because I learned so much, you know, and basically it's not, he wouldn't really, hey, do this, I don't like that part, and that was it, and here, go outside, and he got an alarm clock out in the garage out there with a timer on it and a cassette tape, you know, and tape yourself, you know, and listen to it, bring it back, you know. I got to put these calls together, you know. So that was kind of how the teaching deal goes, you know. So, and there's hardly any of us that I named, other than, you know, maybe the McCree boys, but Eddie Hart is not going to tell you the same thing that he didn't pioneer ever, you know, a bit of this, you know.
Yeah.
What influence did he have on you, on who you are today, Jeff?
The way I got started in it had nothing to do with, this is something you ain't going to believe, it had zero to do with ducks and geese. There was a contest in Alton, Illinois at an archery shop down there years ago, and I would sell a few calls around, you know, and I was in the contest, but I wasn't into doing anything else. So, you know, I didn't understand the show part. I didn't understand any of this. Anyway, at that time. So as much as I duck and goose hunter, did all that there, I've always been, and, you know, some people know this, but I'd rather shoot a deer with a bow any day. You know, I'd rather kill a big buck any day than kill ducks or geese. But that, I've always kept that as my hobby. But at that time, it was a contest, and I won the big buck contest. And, got some notoriety in a big area, and the guy at the archery shop called me and said, he said, hey, man, he said, at the time there was XI Bows. You ever hear of those? Probably didn't hear them. That's mm-hmm. years ago.
Yeah.
XI Bows. That was a big company at the time. And at the time, the camouflage, there was camouflage, predator camouflage, and all this. Anyway, there's a guy named, do you guys know a man named David Westmoreland? David's a rep for... Oh, gosh, I can't think of the group that he's with right now. I don't know if he's with OutTech or not. He may be with OutTech. But David's with a rep group. He's over at Columbia, Missouri, a great bow hunter. And he had called me. He had called those and said, who is this guy killed this big buck? I need to see this guy. So long story short, David put me on and wants to know if I want to be on a pro staff. I didn't even know what a pro staff hardly was at the time. Sure, I guess, you know, well, here's what's going to mean. I'm going to give you a brand new XI bow of your choice and Easton arrows and all this. Yeah, well, sign me up, you know. I'm just a hillbilly looking for anything like it. So he started me out, got that, and along with his rep group, excuse me, was Primos, was one of them. And Badlands Backpacks, I'm sure you all heard of them. Well, the man from Badlands was his just started. It was his first show or two, and it was really cool getting to know that guy, all these people when they were first starting. And there was just a whole bunch of people involved in this. So I was like a pro staffer now for this rep group. So now what I got to do, I got to start going to shows. So I'm going to shows, Deer Classics and all this stuff. Well, anyway, then that's just how it started, you know, it started right through there. And then, you know, and at the same time I was doing this, I'm blowing goose calls for Tim. Then Will Primos comes involved in this. And I was selling calls because they wanted me to do the Primos side of things at a show at Dunn Sporting Goods in St. Charles, Missouri, one weekend. And I was standing there by Mark Drury, who's a good friend of mine. And he was, Mark was sitting there, and anyway, we were talking, and I was blowing a call and all this, and in marches Will Primos. They picked him up at the airport, and here he comes in, and, man, I'm like, wow, this is Will Primos, you know. He comes back there, and he said, hey, man, we're trying to build a goose call. He said he heard me. He said, I heard you blowing that goose call. We're trying to build a call. I need some help with this. Can you help me? And blah, blah, blah. You know, he talks 100 miles an hour, and then I'm like, I don't know, I guess, you know. So I started when we do these shows, and I started with Will. And I could have took off at that point and went with Will and probably still been there today, you know. And I don't know. And Westmoreland was trying to get me to do it. He goes, man, you're wanting this business. This is your opportunity. And you know, the reason I didn't do it, because I didn't want to stop blowing calls for Tim. So we're just such yeah. good friends. And I told Wilbur, I said, you don't have a call that I can win with. Of course, that didn't go over very good. And, but it was the truth at the time, you know. He just had a hunting call, you know, and Tim yeah. had a, you know, comp call. And I didn't want, and it was either, I was kind of put to me, either you do one or the other, you know. And so I thought, well, don't make me choose. And so anyway, that's kind of how, and that grew Tim and I closer. And then his ex-wife and my ex-wife were friends, and the kids are Hunter and and Cole were little bitty kids together growing up, and they'd come up deer hunting and at the house, spend a lot of time together, and we just kind of all, a lot of times I'd go pick Hunter up, and he's a kid after school, you don't come down to go hunting, and it was just, we just kind of grew together, you know, after that. So, yeah, it was a very, very sad day when he passed away. We lost a great man last year.
Yep.
So,
go ahead.
Am I allowed to, I don't know if you want to get into this. I don't even know if it's a good or bad story. When you left him and started your own call company,
wasn't
was
good.
Tim one of those guys that wished you your best, wished you the best?
I can tell a story. I mean, and he wouldn't care. We've talked about it ever since. No, it wasn't a good deal. I promise you that. It was terrible. It was a tough time. The way it happened was, I would always sit down, and anybody that's in that messes with calls or whatever is always taking one piece out of one and putting it in the other one and trying this and changing this and filing tone boards and, you know, you're doing all that. And the goose call part, goose calls always was just, I don't know, something really about the goose hunting, you know, really I just fell in love with, and the goose calls, you know, and shaving reeds and figuring this out. And that was all new back then. And so, anyway, I was just, I just kept putting parts together and doing this and doing that. And so I had a buddy of mine that was in, and I had one call. I'd put three different pieces together, and I thought, man, this is it. And then we'd turn the barrel, and it didn't look very good, you know, and shove different parts in it, you know, and whatever. So anyway, buddy of mine in Michigan, a good friend of mine up in Michigan, his good friend was a machinist up at a big machine shop, and I kept talking. I said, man, I like big. And Grounds kept telling me, I need to build a duck call. You need to build a duck call. You need to build a duck call. This, and he said, you're the duck caller. You don't need to build a duck call. I said, well, I don't know. We'll see. I'll see what I can do. So anyway, so I go to build a duck call with this machinist. We start building this duck call. Well, I shouldn't even tell this business-wise, but the truth of it is, Bill knows this. A duck call, if a goose call is $160, a duck call should be $200. Because it's a little tougher to build it. I mean, there's more parts in that goose call, and more you got to do to it to throw it. But the basic call itself that gets turned on a lathe is two holes, and it might be all different dimensions and all that, but it's two holes. Now, a tone board on a J-frame duck call, and to me, that's the only duck call there is, but a J-frame duck call is tough. One thousandth is this. Anybody's been in a duck call business will tell you one half of a thousandth makes all the difference in the world, you know. And there's so many.
It's light or it's junk.
It's perfect or it's garbage, you know, one of the two.
Yeah.
So and no matter where it's the keyhole, it don't matter what it is. I mean, where the wedge goes, anything can throw that whole call off. So we start building duck call. Well, we've pulled every hair we had over our heads within 3 days trying to build this tone board, and it's just okay. You know, it's not good. It's just okay, and you better have a set of lungs on you to blow it. So, anyway, we built the duck call. I said, well, heck with this, and I had this goose call with me. And I said, he said, I was blowing that goose call while he was jacking around one day in there, and he said, because them guys are all goose hunters up there, and he said, well, let me build that. And I said, all right, what do you mean, Billy? He said, well, I can turn that thing. I'll turn one of them in no time. So we measured it all up and everything, and I said, well, I'd like to put this big band on there, and that way I can make a wood with it. I'll cap it and hold the wood and do this, and I want to put O-rings, but I want the O-rings on the inside, and we do all this. First we'll make it just a press fit. Anyway, long story short, we made this, and next thing we knew, we come out with this goose call. I threw a set of guts in it, and I'm like, whoa, we got something here. We got something I ain't blew before. And so we start putting our mind in this goose call. So we made, I don't know, half a dozen of them, something like that. And I said, man, this is going good. He goes, well, I'm going to make some more, a bunch of acrylic, I'll make some more. So he starts turning them, but we're working on a duck call. So we made 20 duck calls. So we get the duck calls going, and Grounds is on me. Hey, Bob, we got the show coming up down in Memphis. You got that duck call? You got that duck call? You can sell them at the booth. So, all right, so I went out to the Amish people out home, and they made me a round turntable with pegs on it. I put the duck calls on, and away we go to Memphis Ducks Unlimited show. So we go down there, and Freddie is going to make a duck call at the same time. So we're pretty anxious to see who's doing what. Now, we've already had a little split at the time. So Freddie and I have. So anyway, I brought the duck call down there, and so we're selling duck calls, and I'm selling quite a few, and Freddie brings his up and shows us his duck call and all that. So anyway, that night, I've had this goose call in my pocket, and Freddie kept going, when are you going to show grounds that goose call? When are you going to show? That's too good. We got to do it because we're getting ready. We're thinking about going to business for ourselves, you know. And I said,
and
I don't know,
another,
you know.
And that's a story in itself we'll
exactly.
get into next week, but go ahead.
Yeah. So I take the goose call, and I'm telling you, Tim was an unbelievable guy. He was a very, very intimidating guy, you know. I mean, everybody respected him, but he was, man, you know, I mean, he's a very dominating, intimidating type person. I mean that in a good way. It was a good characteristic he had, you know. I mean, he's a very, you know,
personal space meant nothing to Tim.
Excuse me?
Personal space meant nothing to Tim.
Nothing. Nothing. He, yeah. He loved you to death. He loved
whether
the Lord,
he's happy
he
with you or not, he's in your face.
It don't ever, yeah, exactly. So we're in a hotel room. I took the call, had it in my pocket, had it tuned up perfect. Anyway, got my pocket. He's sitting on the bed, and I forget who was in there with him in the room, but I forget who it was at the time. I think it was Casey Hancock. You know Coon, Casey Hancock?
Yeah.
I think that's who it was. Anyway, so and he goes, hey, Bob, what's going on? Where are we going to go eat? You know, and so I said, I don't care. I said, here, I want to show you something. He goes, what's that? And I flipped him that call. He was sitting on the bed and flipped the call. Hey, what's this deal? And I said, just something I made is making them duck call. And it was black and white. And, man, he took off on that thing and sung a song. He goes, hey, here's what we're going to do. Immediately, he goes, hey, Bob, here's what we're going to do. He just come out with a wooden Super Mag, and that's all he had. It was just a half a dozen of them, you know, and that was it. And so, or maybe it was, he was getting ready to or something. Anyway, long story short, we're going to call this a baby Super Mag. We're going 50-50 on it, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're going to make them in black and white. Now, I haven't said a word yet. Nothing. He just come out, and like I said, he's, and so, I'm like, well, okay, we'll just make them two, and next week you send them down to so-and-so that turns them, and we're going to do this and send samples and do this, and I'll call him, and I'm like, whoa, my whole world is flipped upside down. I don't even waste, you know. So at first I'm you're honored, but then I'd ask everybody, what do we get? You know, and they said, dude, go do this for yourself. You know, take this thing, you built it, you go out and you sell this thing. And, man, it was one of the hardest choices I ever had in my entire life. And the next week, he called me up about some duck calls. He goes, hey, did you send that sample down there? And about that time, the guy just sent me 60 of these straight meat honkers. And I didn't, you know, that's why I said he got all this extra acrylic. And he comes down and he goes, oh, now this is how much. And I've got this big bill. And they're all different colors. And now he sends me a bill. I've got to pay for it. And I've got all these. So that helped influence my deal. And I said, Tim, I got all these, you know, calls. I've got to do something with them. He goes, hey, we ain't using them with the limit junk. And I said, I got to pay for them. So that was a little piece that helped. And I finally decided I'm going to do this myself. So at that point, he was asking about the relationship. It went down the tube fast at that point. And gosh, I can't tell you how many years, a lot of years, Bill can tell you, it wasn't good, you know, it was rivalry,
no,
you know, it was not good, and then one day, and it hurt, you know, I know it hurt both of us, you know, but it hurt, and then one day, I was at Paducah, Kentucky at a show, and a big show, and I set up a booth, and I looked up, and here he come, and he come marching up that aisle, and he's coming 100 mile an hour up that aisle, and I told him, look to my boys and go, well, he's either going to turn our table over, we're either going to fight, or he's going to turn right or left and walk away from us, just glare us down. And he walked straight up to me, and I didn't know where to be ready to fight or talk or what, and he stuck his hand out, and he said, it's all over, bud, I found the Lord. And I just stood there, and I knew what he was talking about. And he goes, I found Jesus Christ. It's all over now. No more fights. We ain't doing nothing, you know. We're brothers. We're going to do this here. And I'm going to make 50,000 Bibles. And he did. And I want you to go with me, and we're going to tell our story and all this here. And I was like, whoa. He just floored me again, you know. And I'm like, so
wow.
We got talking. It's all good ever since that day. So
I remember Tim at the International one year telling me about, I mean, he kind of gave me his testimony. And you could tell he was still Tim Grounds, but he was a different person.
Yeah, he didn't you know, his brother did his funeral service. His brother's a preacher, Drew, and a great guy, and it was unbelievable. You know, he told his kind of his whole story about him, you know, and then, the man loved his Lord. You know, he's looking down, listening to this right now, and he's happy. I'm telling it. I promise you. So.
How long did that go on for, Jeff? I mean, the not speaking.
I'm going to say 5-6 years, 6 years probably.
That sounds about right.
The weight that was lifted off of you the day that he walked back in that booth, what was it like?
It was like you took the world off my shoulders, you know.
Because that's a guy you looked up to, and you don't want any bad feelings between...
And I knew at the time, it wasn't just me. It wasn't just me. It was a bad deal because of all of our guys, you know. It was so bad, Bill will tell you, it was so bad. You couldn't be friends with other guys in the bullpen and all this, you know. I mean, it was a battle, you know, for years. You know, it was a battle back and forth, you know. It was a tough battle, you know.
I helped run a lot of those goose calling contests, and, you know, it was my job to try to stay on good footing with all of you. And it could be a damn difficult thing.
Oh, it was. It was tough. It was a real tough deal back then. It was tough for us. And I mean, you went into places, you know, and you were like, you go to a contest, you were armed and ready, and, you know, and just not that you're going to have a fight or nothing, but you were just watching for, I don't know, anything they did different or whoever. It was a real tough deal. You know, but you know, and then for like all the callers, and for Cole, and for Hunter, and for, you know, so it was all good after that. So,
well, and you had all the people who weren't necessarily callers, but they hung around it, and they gravitated to one team or another, and it's not just him and you, but Zink's guys off there for a period of time. It was the hangers on, I guess you'd call them, probably instigated more garbage than anyone.
Oh yeah, and then right after that is when the deal didn't work out. Me and Freddie, and so that was all between. And it wasn't just a battle with, wasn't this battle with Tim? Tim didn't like Freddie. He didn't like me. I didn't like either one of those. It was just, and Freddie didn't like either one of us. And it was a battle, you know, for 5-6 years. You know.
It was duck call. People will understand this. It was a lot like Butch Reichenbach with most of the other call makers that came out in the late 80s and through the 90s.
There's a good one, I can tell you. I got the biggest kick out of that. Butch, once I became a call maker, he stopped talking to me.
That's Butch.
That's the truth. Yeah, it was funny, and I was like, man, that crabby old man won't talk to nobody, you know, and I tried to talk to him and all that. Now he couldn't talk to me no more. And then the last good thing is the second senior division they had at Stuttgart, you know. I didn't even know there was such a thing. And I was down there, had a booth, and somebody comes, oh, yeah, Charles Petty just won the senior division. What are you talking about? How old would you got to be? And they said 55. And I'm like, whoa, I could have got in that. I'm getting in that next year. So I went into it, and Butch was back there, you know, and heck, we were just fine then. And I was blowing good at the time and everything, you know, and that's why, you know. And he was like, you know, we were just couldn't have been better buddies ever, you know. And I'm really glad that time happened, because I never got to see the man much after that, you know. So,
right.
But yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of history in it.
Hey Jeff, before we go today, I bet the first time that you guys not arm in arm or hand in hand, no, but together again, being seen by the public, I bet there were some big eyes in the crowd.
Oh yeah, it was a tough deal. People were looking at, you know, and I know all my guys. When he left the booth, he was there, and like I said, he's very dominating, you know. And he's, you know, and he, and I got a kick out of him. He said, and everybody's going, he goes, and I forgive you, and all this. And I thought, well, what did I do, you know? But I was just happy we were good, you know, and he was good.
Yeah.
And so I sat there for a while, and we're all, what just happened? You know, I go, I don't know. I really don't know. I said, I don't know. I'm going to go outside and find out. So I went outside, and he was sitting there on a bench out there, watched the contest. And I sat down and said, hey, what's up? You know, and I said, you know, is this all, you know, we're good? He said, it's all good, man. And he was wanting me to go with him and a different contest and start a revival tents and stuff, a calling contest and stuff. I said, Tim, I ain't the man for this. And I wasn't in my religious deal where I am today. Probably if he'd done that today, I'd have probably said, yeah, let's do it. Because he had quite a testimony, but I didn't even understand what a testimony was at that time. And so anyway, and it was awesome, and then we'd go places, and he started calling each other, and then he called me up, and goes, hey, Bob, I ain't been in the show business for 10 years, I need to get back out there. He goes, tell me where to go. So I went, hey, go to this one, and he'd start going to shows, and we'd get a booth right across from me, and he'd help each other. So it was fun, and then we had a lot of fun, like we'd be at shows, and if I got there before he did, I'd put a sticker up on his banner behind where he couldn't see it, free Tim Grounds, one on my booth, say free Tim Grounds call, with every acrylic call purchase here at Foils, get a free Tim Grounds call or something. And they'd go over his booth and go, hey, I just bought a Foils call. Where's my call? Hey, Bob, what are you talking about? And it was just... one time I come in, my whole call rack, all the calls, I had a cloth table because they had security. All the calls were off the rack in a box underneath the bench behind there, and I had solid beer cans stuck on every one of them, across there. So, yeah, I mean, it's just stuff like that, It's just, we had a lot of fun.
So was the relationship, you kind of looked up to him. Then you went through a state where you didn't talk, and then... you come out of this as peers and best friends.
Mm-hmm. It was good. And then, just before, it was a Friday before he died, and I just talked to him. I was going to come up there the next day and see him, and we didn't. And he called me, and I missed the call. And the next thing he is in an accident. He's dead. And it's funny how life works, But yeah, he was a great man, and you were, I don't want to say you were scared of him, but you looked up to him at a point, when he was, he's just, like I said, he's a very dominating guy, and knew what he's doing. I mean, he was great at his business. He was a pioneer, so you looked up to him, and that's the way he was, he was just a great guy. I mean, I could tell you stories for hours upon hours, and everybody that ever met the man's got the same thing, funny, you could laugh till you're crying, but he was, he had fun wherever he went,
I'll add to that, Jeff. I mean, Tim was a big guy. Physically, he just, mm-hmm. He looked bigger than he was, I think.
Exactly, yeah.
And I'm not, as both of y'all know.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I always look forward to seeing Tim. He was never anything. We had wonderful times together. We've been on stage emceeing together. We've blown in contests together and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I always look forward to seeing him. I always want to see him again. But I never recall not being a little bit uncomfortable most of the time.
He had that way, especially if you didn't know him really well, but he had that way about him, and almost anybody they knew would tell you that. But I will tell you one, I'll get off but off on that subject, but I've got to tell you one funny story. In the height of all this hatred and competition and all this here, both of us at the time were winning a lot, and there'd been a year we'd win more than he would, and it was tough. So we were at Eastern Maryland. And, of course, the Goose Call, now he's got his guys, and I got mine, and I'm blowing. And I don't know if he blew it or not in a contest, but I'm blowing. We're all blowing. So that night, I decided to get in the Mason-Dixon duck calling thing. So I had practiced, and I thought, man, I'm going to be the first one ever to win both those contests, So Tim gets in the duck calling thing. So it comes down that night to the final five. Okay, well, it ain't too bad before that because there's 50 people in there blowing, So now it's down to five people, and it's me and him, and I forget who it was, and the other three guys, and some good duck callers and all that. It's very privileged to even be there with them. And so for the people out there who don't understand this, a duck caller will sit back there, and he'll take a dollar bill out, and he will go behind his reed and tone board and wipe that off, wipe the spit off of it, and dry his tone board out, and that's just what everybody does, Done it for years. Mm-hmm. So Tim always got a roll of money on him. He's sitting catty-cornered across from me, and he whips out a $50 bill and takes it behind there, and he's doing that, and he looks up at me and wanting me to see that he's got a 50 on there. Well, I used to do this all the time. My dad told me, he said, always fold up a 100 and put it in your pocket just in case you need it. So I'd had one in there that had mold on it. So I reached up there, and I thought, 50's good, 100's better. So I popped that unfolded deal where he'd hear it, and I run that 100 behind there and made sure he seen it. He ain't happy. He is not happy at this. We went out there, blew it, and got down to the last. They're calling off the people. And, okay, you know, we're down here in the final two, and it was me and him standing there. The two enemies standing there. And the two non-duck callers on top of this, you know. And we there's a lot of duck callers, man, because me and him stand there, you know. But we both had practiced good, you know. And I beat him by a point, and I always wanted to turn to him and go, should have used 100. But it was kind of, it was pretty cool, you know. So anyway, yeah, and I ended up getting second in the goose that year. I thought, dang it, if I just won the goose, I'd had it both. But yeah, it was kind of a funny story. And when we laughed about it, he goes, yeah, I seen you pull out 100. I was mad. He goes, so it's kind of a funny story. But, yeah, we had a lot of fun.
Wow.
And, but he was killing a machine.
You know, the only thing that I walk that I say about this podcast, whether it be a story, whether it be tips, or whether it be whatever we do on this podcast, but whoever's listening to this walks away a little bit better. If you don't walk away from this podcast today a little bit better of a man or woman, you didn't listen to Jeff. You didn't listen to what he had to say. Great podcast, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you. Anxious to do the next one.
great episode. Listen. And next week, and we talked about this a little bit pre-production, is a relationship between you and Fred.
Right, yeah, that, yeah. There's a, and so everybody knows we're good, you know, good now too, you know. And I would say this, but while we're on there real fast about that, Fred is married to a wonderful woman, Dawn, and she could use everybody's prayers, and that's all I'll say about it. She could use a lot of our prayers. A great woman has done a lot for the industry and has been involved in it for years, so... yeah, if everybody just give her a few prayers, that'd be great.
Alex, very special lady.
Yes, she is, yeah.
I really, really look forward to that story next week, Jeff. Bill, thank you again for being here, Jeff. Thank you again. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.